Welcome to Witchlit, a podcast where we talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, fiction author, witch, and nosy Scorpio. For more than 10 years, Dawn Martin, as Firelight, interviewed self-identified witches, fairy experts, goblin hunters, paranormal investigators, and even a werewolf on his podcast, Inciting a Riot. His thousands of listeners worldwide tuned in as he examined magic, witchcraft, paganism, and spiritual seekership through a diverse, inclusive lens with a balance of modern science, critical thought, and pop culture. The podcast has recently been relaunched as Head on Fire, a bi-weekly conversation with experts in interesting and often overlooked fields. He's published a book of poetry, While I Wait to Be a God Again. His latest book is The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. He lives in the Chicago suburbs with his husband and a vast array of fur children. Dawn Martin, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. This is like between interviewing you and Corey Thomas Hutchison, I feel like I've interviewed the OG of pagan podcasters.
Oh gosh, thank you. I hate that it's true, but it's true.
Well, it's still, you can, it's still a very young field. Let's put it that way. It's still a very young field overall.
Yes.
You guys have been doing it a lot longer than most of us. So.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I was 12 years old when I started my first podcast. So yeah, that's very impressive.
Very impressive for a 12-year-old.
I was a precocious child.
So my first question for everybody on the show is why write? Because you're also a podcaster. You have lots of other irons in the fire. So why write on top of that?
Because I can't do anything else. And that's the most cliche writer answer ever. But I fell in love with writing when I was in fifth grade. My fifth grade teacher's classroom, we had a poetry assignment. And I wrote poems and they got perfect grades. And I fell in love with the art form. And I dove headfirst into writing poems and then short stories. And, you know, they were bad. They're really bad. But, I just fell in love with just the compulsion of writing and the stories that you can create and the ways that you can express yourself. And it's something that no matter where I've gone in life or, what lemons seem to be ricocheting at my head at any given time, I always have writing in some kind of form. It has always been there for me. Sometimes it's been hard. Sometimes it's been, a struggle to do because you know, so many writers struggle with, am I a real writer? Am I a legitimate writer? Can I call myself a writer? Because I haven't published yet, or I've only published in a couple of small mags or something like that. And I write because I can't not write.
I mean, like you said, I think it is an answer that a lot of people have. We also have a very similar origin story. I also started writing in fifth grade with poetry assignments. Like a secret fifth grade teacher cabal.
Did you go through a phase of writing World War II poetry? Because I got very into so here was my poetry journey. In sixth grade, I wrote a 6-page poem from the perspective of a guy who had just landed. It right smack in the middle of, like, he was a soldier in World War II, I guess. And it was also his birthday. So it was like this just epic poem that he died on his birthday in World War II. And I was very into World War II poetry when I was 10. and then I got very into the beatniks for like years. I was very into like the 60s and I got very into slam poetry. And I did like competitive slam competitions all the way through college. And that's how I got good, because there is nothing as vicious as college English students at a slam competition. And if you were bad, they are going to destroy you. But yeah, my early voices were like Gregory Corso and Lawrence Ferlinghetti and like all of those folks. And I remember when Jewel did her book of poetry, like that like rocked my world. So yeah.
Yeah, our paths diverged a little bit. I thought I was going to write like Japanese haiku poetry. That was my, and then I got big to money college there. And then I got to college and found out nobody writes that anymore, Victoria. Yeah, have to do something else.
Big money in poetry.
Huge money in poetry. Yeah. Yeah. But I did not do slam poetry, but I did do like intense Iowa writers workshop style workshops. Those mm-hmm. are also pretty vicious. They can.
Oh
be.
Yeah. 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 I will say, I did it proper. I also took like, you know, senior level poetry classes and was an English major for a while before I switched to criminal justice. And I took a ton of creative writing and poetry classes. And I was also vicious. I was also vicious. I was like, what is this? This is bad. This is nothing. This is a center aligned rhyming couple. What is this? Stop it. This is no. I was bad. I was an asshole.
We grow. So we touched a little bit on kind of your writer origin story. So what did that, how did that translate into basically getting published? Because you've published independently, self-published poetry, and then you've also published with like a big five publisher. So what did that look like?
Yeah, I did. I guess, you know, that classic.
Big four, I guess.
Yeah, technically Penguin Random House bought Simon and Schuster, or they've merged, I guess. The president likes to send us lots of emails about what's really happening. I don't know. But Simon and Schuster is one of the rare purchases that is still operating as Simon and Schuster, like that's not Penguin Random House Simon and Schuster or something.
I always Purse. Lament that they missed the opportunity to call themselves Random Penguin.
I see, but now you could call them Purse.
This is true.
You could call them Purse. Yeah, you know, that classic story of independently publishing two poetry books and then get a book deal with a big five. You know, just how that always happens. No,
always.
Always. Like many people, like many creative people, writers especially, you know, I was like, you know, I've got a novel in me. I know that I do, but if I just had the time to write, you know, I wrote short stories because I don't have the time for a full length book. I kind of get bored right in the middle of it. But then the pandemic happened and I started working from home and I had time for the first time in my life. And a very dear friend of mine and I kind of made a bet month and into the pandemic. We said, well, what if we try? You know, we've both said for years, if we ever had time, we would try, we would write. We've got time now, let's do it. So, you know, we tried to set a goal for ourselves, and it was I took advice, the Terry Pratchett advice of write 400 words a day at minimum. 400 words a day. It's not much. 400 words is not much. It's not even a full page. And sometimes you're going to get 400 words done in 10 minutes, and sometimes 400 words is going to take all day. But 400 words is an achievable number that you can hit in a day. And we said, okay, well, if we do that, we'll have a 50,000 word manuscript by, you know, Halloween. And then maybe we could revise during Nano, and, you know, then, hey, we'll have written a manuscript for a book, you know? And, I was doing that. I was right smack in the middle of writing a novel. And then, some blogs I wrote got the attention of Simon and Schuster. And so we started having a conversation, and it led to, you know, they said, well, you know, it was a long conversation about some other stuff. And just sort of in the middle of that, I said, hey, while I'm talking to Simon and Schuster, here's this book. Cause they said, you know, have you ever thought about writing a witchy book? And a book for this audience. And I said, oh, you would never want to publish the book that I would write. I said, yes, I have toyed with the idea of writing a witchy book. I've had the outline for a witchy book in my notes app for many, many, many years. And every time I think of, oh, this is what I wish was in a witchy book. This is what I wish we would just say in black and white. I put it in my notes app and it's in my outline and yada, yada. And they said, what do you mean? I was like, oh, you know, the kind of book that I would want to write y'all would not want to publish it, at least not for this audience. That's nobody would buy it. Nobody would buy this book. They said, well, let us see what you have. So I did. So I sent them all of my notes and all of my outline and kind of all of my thoughts over the years. And they said, oh my God, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, please let us please buy this book from you. So I stopped writing my novel and I started writing The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. And now I'm finishing up that novel. So
awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, like just in talking to people over the first season, like how many people were approached to write a book. And I think part of that is like the witch community is, I hate to use the word incestuous because that's not the thing I want to add to it, but it is like one degree of separation from everybody.
Yeah.
So I think once, you know, your name is in that pot and somebody decides, oh, we need this, then it is a little easier to find someone to write.
Yeah. But the thing is that usually happens.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. But that's the thing is that usually happens at, you know, the pagan big two, you mm-hmm. know, you have your Llewellyn, you have your Wiser,
right.
You know, and there's like, you know, a handful of editors. And those folks come find, or they tell an author to tell you to pitch them a book or something, you know,
I was curious, like Simon and Schuster, that does it seem like that's how that would work? Like this seems a little kind of out of the, what I would assume they would be interested in even.
Which I think is why it worked, because, they are big enough that they could take the risk on a book mm-hmm. like this.
Yeah.
Because it says things that I love my community and I value supporting niche presses and small presses. And I think that they have helped to create the backbone of this community. However, there is just a level of frankness and honesty about certain parts of our community that they just aren't going to publish. They just mm-hmm. aren't. It would not serve them well to do that. So I think that's why it worked, because they're a big enough publisher that they're like, no, we're not going to lose money. We're not going to lose sleep on your book. So yes, we will happily take a chance on this. Yeah. So I'm glad. And it seems to have worked out.
Okay. So now that you've published this book, you're working on your novel, like how much of your life is writing now? Cause you still have a full-time job.
You still have a podcast, which seems like it should be a full-time job. It's
so,
a lot.
So how much do you actually get to write?
I do still have my 400 word a day word count. And some days I write more and some days I write less. And some weeks, I will say, I have now made it more of like a 2,000 words a week word count instead of 400 words a day. I will write something every day. Mm-hmm. But sometimes there are just some days when there's just no time. And so I get 10 minutes. So I write for those 10 minutes. But yeah, I mean, it's weird how much of a compulsion it becomes. It really does become this like compulsive thing where you're just like, oh God, I didn't write today. I need to write something. And even if it's a sentence that you end up deleting tomorrow and you write over it, you wrote something today. It's like going to the gym or, you know, drinking that glass of water in the morning or whatever it is. It just becomes part of your routine. But walking out of the house without putting your wedding ring on or something, you're just like, oh God, I'm forgetting something. What, there's something I haven't done. What am I missing? That kind mm-hmm. of thing.
Yeah. So what would you say your goals are now? Like obviously to finish this novel, but do you have yep. like mountains you want to climb with your writing or what's
the Yeah. Oh yeah. And any writer who tells you otherwise is lying through their teeth. There is not a writer out there that doesn't want to be Stephen King or something. Come on. We all want to be best. We all want to write full time, or we all want to work for ourselves full time. I would love in the next 3 to 5 years for my life to look like a full-time writer, podcaster, that kind of thing. I would love to do this full-time. And hopefully, you know, hopefully if a few more books get out there and they maybe hit the right audience at the right time, maybe it'll happen. But I've got sky high ambition, and I am very blessed that I have that I waited long enough to publish, that I have created a very strong network of friends and allies and people in the right places that can help me get there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that a lot of folks dive headfirst and then they're kind of not prepared for what this world can look like and what the publishing journey can look like. I tell every writer that wants to be a writer, every person that wants to be a writer and wants to publish and do this legit, make friends with other better writers. Make friends with people who are better than you. Get ready to receive the criticism. Get ready to have your work just utterly ripped apart. Don't get mean people, but get people who will kindly, gently take a hacksaw to your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
editors and beta readers who are honest with you are your best friends.
I had probably one of the most thorough beta reads for a witchy book that I think one could have. I think I had something like 25 beta readers for this book. And half of them have doctorates or just are, you know, experts in their field. Mm-hmm. And I was like, listen, I spend an entire book saying that I am not the expert, and there's a lot of very hefty territory that I try to cover here. So I want to go to the actual voices from these communities, actual voices that are actual experts in these fields. And I want them to just, I said, no holds barred, tear it apart. Mm-hmm. And they did. And the book is better for it. And, you know, about 25,000 more words were added, and, you know, it became a much, much stronger book. So I think, and people were really surprised. Like the beta readers were surprised. My editor was surprised. My copy editors were surprised. They were like, you know, usually people have a little bit more ego about this. And I was like, this is my first book. Like, I am not Stephen King. I'm not precious about my work. Like, I want this to be good. I don't want this to serve my ego. So mm-hmm. like, let's tear it down. Let's make it good. You know, this is my first time writing nonfiction. But you know, I've blogged for years. If you put it all together, I've written many books, but you know, I was like, it needs to serve the community that it wants to, that it's seeking mm-hmm. to serve. And it's not going to do that if what it's serving is my ego. So yeah, it had a very thorough beta read with some very generous beta readers. It's much better for it. But I mean, make friends with writers that are farther along in their careers, that can tell you what the pitfalls are, that can help you read a contract. You know, if you can't afford a lawyer, have somebody that I'm very grateful for the folks that I, you know, and it's because I spent years interviewing other mm-hmm. authors. And, you know, I did have the benefit of kind of having that network of people because I'd had a podcast for so many years. So when it came time for me to go on this journey, for when it was finally my time, I had a huge circle of people that I could say, hey, what does this mean? How do I read this in my contract? What kinds of things should I ask for? Should I even be writing this book? There were entire chapters of Dabbler's Guide that got taken out. You know, there's a huge chapter that was actually the most researched chapter in the book. I'd read more books for that and done more research for that chapter than just about any other chapter. And the only thing that survives of that chapter is a single paragraph in a different chapter, because it was shot to the end of it and it got through the beta read. And it was just like, well, it's fine, but it's only a chapter and this needs to be a book, you know, or this is such a big topic and you're trying to squeeze it into, and it just wasn't serving it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't right. I was like, somebody else needs to write that book, not me. I'm not the right voice there. So, it got taken out and, you know, just kill your darlings, kill your ego and write the book that needs to be written instead mm-hmm. of the book that's going to serve your ego. Sorry. Yeah. That's a very long-winded answer.
No. And I think that what you touched on is so important about that. You have to kind of come into this work kind of humbly, especially new. And, you know, my comment to my first developmental editor was like, I just don't want to embarrass myself. I don't want to embarrass you. I don't want to embarrass myself. You know, like, I want to make sure that this book deserves to be in the world. I mean, I don't think it's the best thing that's ever been written by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think it's the best thing I've written, but that book is out there and it's okay enough that I'm not embarrassed that it exists in the world, because I was like, no, you need to tell me if this is bad.
So. Well, and I, you know, to be very frank, I also knew the kind of voice that I had been. I had been a pretty harsh critic of some other voices out there. I had been a pretty harsh critic of some other books. So I knew that if I was going to put a book out there, it needed to yeah. be all of the things that I always wished I had seen in books. It needed to be very well researched. It needed to cite its sources. It needed to have a very specific point of view, and it needed to advance the conversation in some way. I was so tired of seeing the same book repackaged, you know, once a quarter, every quarter, forever into perpetuity in some form or fashion, just with a different author's name on it, just the same mm-hmm. intro book being written with the same 40 pages of introductory material and the same 150 pages of spells. They exist for someone, but I just needed a different book out there. And yeah. So I wrote it.
So usually I ask people like what the seed for their book is, but I think that we've kind of covered that and you talked sure. about that on your podcast. But one thing I would like to ask kind of in that vein is like, how do you think that your practice would be different now if you had read this book when you started, if you'd read your own book, the book you wrote now?
I would not have bought so many things. I think I would have not have bought so many things. And I think I would have felt okay looking silly. And I think I would have taken myself a lot less seriously in some aspects mm-hmm. and a lot more seriously in others. But yeah, I would have spent a lot less time buying stuff. You know, I spent a lot of money on very pretty ritual blades and, you know, like $100 on this gorgeous wand with all the crystals and stuff attached to it that had been blessed by the, and all those things sit in drawers and they don't get used. And that's just not what my practice has looked like. My practice looks very, you know, mundane. I've, you know, and I just, even now today, anytime I'm trying to like put together something for social media, I'm like, I don't have anything that I do that I feel like is Insta-worthy. I'm just like, mm-hmm. you know, what, do you want to watch me bake some cookies? Yeah, I'm gonna do some magic in the cookies, you know, like that kind of thing. It's like, but that's why I wrote like the spells section the way that I did, because, you know, the folks that I know, and I know a whole lot of practitioners at this point, you know, I've been a podcaster for 13 years. I've been in this community for 20. I know a whole lot of people, and I don't care what they're telling you on Instagram. A whole lot of people are just making shit work with whatever's in their junk drawer in the kitchen. You know, they are making stuff work with what they have on hand. And all of these gorgeous Instagram worthy photos with all of these beautiful expensive tools and all of this custom made this, that, and the other, that is just not what a lot of people's practice looks like on a day-to-day basis. So I think I probably would have bought a whole lot less stuff. And I would have probably, you know, I do spend quite a bit of the book. I think the main through line of the book is encouraging critical thinking and also teaching people what critical thinking looks like. So I probably would have, I don't know. I was a pretty critical thinker, but I think I used critical thinking in a very egoistic way rather than to examine the work. I think I took a lot of things at face value. I assumed that people wrote books had an authority that they didn't necessarily have, because I'm like, well, I'm not enough. I mean, why do I have authority? You know, what, mm-hmm. who am I, you know? So I think I probably would have, bought a whole lot less stuff and, done a little bit more digging into the why behind the what of some of those early books that I read.
Yeah. Do you think writing the book and like doing the research for the book and kind of going down, I assume you also go down research rabbit holes.
Of course.
Do you think those things have impacted your practice now? Like just the course of writing the book has impacted how you practice?
No, it hasn't. Because by the time I wrote Dabbler's Guide, I was very secure in mm-hmm. what my practice is, what my spiritual journey looks like. And also, the book isn't about a specific practice.
Right.
It's a book about sort of the culture and community of magical practitioners as much as it is an introduction to witchcraft itself. Mm-hmm. That's in there, but it's in there because it's, you know, it still falls into the category of an introductory book. So there's some things that just kind of have to be in it because of the kind of book that it is. Mm-hmm. It is not a book to teach someone a specific practice. It is a book to teach someone about the culture and community of modern magical practitioners, and the kinds of things that are not typically talked about in introductory books. So my practice didn't change because it's not a book about practice. I think it did give me some wake up calls about who I want to be in the community though, which obviously turned themselves into a name reclaiming and a relaunch and a rebrand and all of that, and just sort of reorienting myself in the community and the kind of voice I want to be. And so it did give me that wake up call, I suppose. Mm.
That's been a big change for you to be out. And I know there are pitfalls in that too. And actually Corey and I talked really early on when I interviewed him about, like, when I published, I used my own name, even though it was kind of suggested I shouldn't, because I'm a woman writing contemporary fantasy. I'm a woman, you know, all those kind of things. I was like, no, my dream is to have my book on the shelf with my name on it. You know, so I'm going to use my name. But I think there is this, that to take that step publicly, like, I was, you know, nobody knew who I was. Nobody really still knows who I am. But I'm real easy to find if you do know my name. And so there is, like, I guess a safety aspect to it, as well as just like the being out there publicly as a witch in a country that, depending on where you are, that goes bad for you or that goes okay for you, or nobody cares, you know? So, I mean, what was the process of kind of coming to terms with all of that, I guess?
You know, what was funny is that I didn't really have the big, like, reckoning with it until it came time to sign the contract. And when I got sent the contract, my editor was like, okay, whose name is on the cover of the book? And I was like, oh shit, whose name is on the cover of the book? You know, this is my first major publication. I want credit for my work, but I said, but nobody knows who that is. So if I had written a book under my name, at the time, I was like, you know, nobody would, you know, I don't have the biggest audience in the world, but Firelight had an audience. Mm-hmm. Firelight was a known quantity. Firelight had been writing and publishing since Witchbox, since Ren Walker and, you know, all of that, and blogging for many, many years, and had, you know, thousands and thousands of listeners and stuff like that. So it made sense. But I will say, after the fact, it also made sense to publish under that name, because that felt like the culmination of everything that Inciting a Riot had been. Mm-hmm. The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft is very much the voice of the persona of Firelight, the journey that I went on through Inciting a Riot, the kinds of conversations that I had, the kind of poking at convention that Inciting a Riot did, that much more pointed perspective. So it made sense that Firelight's name is on that. It almost feels like a friend of mine wrote it, almost. Like it's very much like I'm glad his name is on it. I'm glad he got the credit for that, because he earned that. He did a lot of work to get there. And I'm glad he's not writing any more books.
I mean, one thing I will have, you know, reading the book, like, two things I really took away from it. I told you this when we were talking before. It was like, it's the first witchy space book I've read and just laughed out loud at, like, the asides and the comments. And there's one place where you say something, you know, it's like, I can't remember exactly how it's written, but Like, if you find it, can you tell me why I'm like that too? Like, if you find the reason this thing exists, can you tell me why I'm that way too? And I was like, oh my God, I just identified with that so much. It's like, if you figure this out, let me know. But it's also incredibly frank. And I just so appreciate that. That it's kind of like you said, like that voice of, you know, our community is not perfect. And our community has a lot of the same pitfalls and, you know, sketchy alleyways that other religious communities have. And well, I'm going to lay this all out for you.
Because religious community or no, we're all still people. Right. And I have a social science background. I mean, you know, formal education, and I didn't end up spending all of my years in research or something like that, but at least, you know, my brain is sort of programmed mm-hmm. from a social science perspective. And so, I always look at groups and group dynamics and things like that. And our community is still just a group of people. And why are we the way that we are? Because we're just a group of people. You know, right. There is nothing inherently different about us than any other group. And that's something that I just wanted desperately to drive home, because the same swindlers that are in our community are in every community. I mean, there's mm-hmm. faith healers out there that are going to take your grandma's money and tell you that they can get you to Jesus and tell you that they can, you know, all of the same claims that they can channel your dead relatives, or they've got messages from God or a saint or something like, you know, the same grifts that we have in our community are the same grifts that exist in other communities. And we think for some reason that we left all those behind. And because there is this mentality that we left all that behind when we came here, we do a very poor job of self-examination. We do a very poor job of highlighting problems and then fixing them. Mm-hmm. Don't just ask questions, seek answers, right? And so many of our dark spaces and the creepy crawly things that we find when we pull over rocks and stuff like that, they just get covered over because no, we are the granddaughters of the witches that you couldn't get an extended warranty for your car or whatever. We keep telling ourselves, because we're such a new community, we're creating this mythos about who we are and how we came here and how this community was formed. And there, even though it's completely ahistorical and has absolutely no basis in reality, we still have this holdover from the last few decades of publishing that's telling us that we are continuing this great unbroken tradition of being priests and priestesses to these ancient gods and living in these liminal spaces and this and that and the other. And that's great to a point, but the problem is that it gives us this sense of identity that tells us that our problems were left behind, and they weren't. And because of that, we have abusers in our community that get away with it. We have bad information that continues to be published and republished because we just won't call it out publicly. And when we do, we won't fix it, because the people that are making money off of it, that they don't want to stop making money off of it. So that's what we were kind of talking about earlier. Why did I publish with Simon and Schuster? Because a pagan publisher would not have published this book. They just would not have.
And I think what you talk about and so many of the chapters is like using your discernment. And it's interesting because I think there's a parallel in wanting to be a writer and a parallel in joining the witchy community, is that like somehow you're going to walk through this magical door and everything on the other side is perfect, right? Mm. Like you're like, it's rainbows and unicorns and everything is beautiful, and drop your discernment at the door because this is a safe space. Well, neither one of those places are safe spaces. I mean, want to talk a writing community has some serious skeletons in the closets mm-hmm. that haven't gotten dealt with for decades because those people are too important to touch or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that just giving that to a new practitioner, or even a practitioner I've been in this space for 30 years, like just reminding them, like, not everybody's got your best interest at heart.
Here's a great fact. And this was something that sort of came out while I was in the editing process for the book, mm-hmm. because I was doing some research for some other podcasty stuff. But this is not any shade on pagan publishing. This is shade on nonfiction writing, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people think that nonfiction writing is vetted and fact-checked, and that there is someone somewhere that has fact-checked the books that we read. And that is not true. And the thing is, it's not just not true in pagan publishing. It's not true industry-wide for nonfiction generally. Any nonfiction book. You want to write a book of a book about history. You want to write a book about World War II, or you want to write a book about, I don't know, the mating habits of, I don't know, South American praying beetles or whatever. I don't know. Whatever it is, it's almost guaranteed to not be fact-checked because it's not an academic space. It's not peer-reviewed. So few of them are fact-checked. For a lot of reasons. One, it's very expensive to fact-check. A lot of smaller presses don't have the resources to do that, especially not for every book. Mm-hmm. Not every book, you know, people are like, well, not every book necessarily needs to be fact-checked. We're just kind of hope that the author has done that fact-checking because, you know, at the end of the day, it's the author's reputation, not ours. We're just right. The publisher or whatever. But the thing is, they're while the onus should be on the author themselves to do their own research, I also very much think that the onus should be on publishing houses to make sure that the product that they're putting out there is in good faith, you know, is being put out there as the best possible product possible. You know, and I had a lot of those conversations with my editor, which is why she did have a fact check for the book. And it was, you know, we added a lot of extra footnotes for, you know, everything in there, every fact that was stated, every quote or everything was, had a footnote for it. But that's the thing is that so many of our books have just bad information out there that continues to get repeated because it's being sourced from other books that were equally not fact-checked. And then that, you know, how did we get the Burning Times myth continually published in witchy publications as fact all the way up through the early to mid 2000s? I mean, just within the last 10 years, we've had books published with this in there as though it's fact. You know, so it's time for us to have a reckoning about the kinds of information that we have out there and the kinds of conversations that we want to have if we want our community to continue to survive and thrive and grow.
Yeah. And the Burning Times thing, I always think about, like, you know, when all those documentaries were being made in the 90s, like, it had already been debunked like 30 years at that point.
Oh yeah. I mean, Murrayite theories had been debunked for decades ago, but they were in books in the 90s. I know they were in books mm-hmm. in the early 2000s. I think I saw some, I mean, I said earlier books in the last mm-hmm. 10 years, I can't actually think of a title off the top of my head, but I do, you know, they
and
are
it still comes
very
up online
recently published.
All the time. Yes! Like, it comes up online all yes! the time. Yeah.
And even if somebody will say, hey, well, maybe parts of it were a myth, they will still parrot other parts of the theory as though it is true mm-hmm. when it's all one big Murrayite, you know, the witch cult of Western Europe theory that has been it's all been debunked. But we've said it over and over again that the spirit of it continues to live on. And mm-hmm. even if we say the facts of it aren't true, we still abide by the fiction of it. Like mm-hmm. I said earlier, that we're just these, you know, continuing this unbroken tradition of being mm-hmm. you know, these priests and priestesses to this, that, and the other. But then using that title to just kind of create whatever we want, which is great and it's beautiful, but I wish we would just say that. I wish we would yeah. just say that's what
that
we were
doing.
That
it is mythos.
Yes.
Yes.
I wish that we would just say it. Just,
well, you
we
just
are
did.
Creating something new. Did. Yes. Yes.
Somebody's saying it. So I guess, I've got a couple more questions for you, and then we'll do our
Please.
Little game of chance question at the end. But what, like, in your dream experience of a reader reading this book, and what would you want them to take away from it?
I want them to take away from it that it is that the magical path is both much more serious than, you know, they may thought of, which probably comes as a comfort to many people. There's a lot of people that take this path very, very seriously. And there's a lot of actual academic work out there. There's people, you know, Owen Davies does brilliant work. There's tons of just brilliant academics out there, brilliant, brilliant work out there that takes the subject very seriously and has some phenomenal ways to study and research and build a magical life that is built on discernment and you know, rational thought and inclusive of science and psychology and things like that, so that it can be taken much more seriously than you want, but also it's not as all serious, but also it can be fun and it can be joyful and it can be silly and it's okay to be silly, and also it's okay to not know anything. It's okay to be new, and it's okay to be new for a really, really, really long time, and it's okay not to do what everybody on social media is doing because it just doesn't feel right now, or it might not ever feel right ever, and that's okay. That is all okay. This is your path and you get to make of it what you want. So you know, I think that there's this pressure to keep up. You know, there's this pressure, there's this speed at which we're supposed to learn and then we're supposed to practice. And for some reason that practice has commerce tied in with it and all of this other stuff. And I just want to encourage newer folks and even experienced people that are kind of tired of the circus that some of this has become, to just, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. It does not have to be that way. Just because that's how a lot of people are making money off of it doesn't mean that has to be something you participate in.
Well, and I think that part about the speed at which we learn, like I said, I mean, I've been in like this witchy space for 30 years.
Sure.
And I still feel like there's books I find out about that have been out for 20 years I didn't know about that I want to go read. I mean, I can't imagine at any point, and maybe that's just like personality or, you know, humanness or whatever, but like, I don't ever want to feel like I know everything. I don't want to be the expert in the room. Like, I don't
I am
want
so excited. I did try to drive home the point many times in the Dabbler's Guide that I am not the expert. Mm-hmm. I guess I might be an authority because I've been here a long time and I'm the one writing right. the book. So with that comes a position of authority, and I get that and I accept that. But I am by no means the expert on any one of mm-hmm. these topics. I am somebody right. that's been here a long time. I'm somebody that's learned some things, and I'm somebody with a, you know, with a background that gives me an interesting perspective into how our community is built. Beyond that, I'm not an expert, and therefore it's okay for you not to be either. Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Yeah. And I think having that, you know, accepting that authority is also like, I have the authority and the self-confidence to say, I don't have the answer to that question for you, and here are places where I think you should go look.
Like, yeah, that's why I continually said, look at the back. Mm-hmm. There's going to be resources for this at the back of the book. The people who can teach you this are at the back of the book,
yeah.
you know, go, and it's not all just books. Do you learn by having conversations? So here's some podcasts to go start your journey. Mm-hmm. Here's some YouTube channels to go start your journey. Here are some, you know, et cetera, like whatever form of media that you want to use as your next step, here are some recommendations. And then here's a way, you know, I list out in the book, you know, once you start, how do you find your next level? You know, how do you go after that? Here's how you do that. You know, go look at the books here and then go to the resources and read those books. And then, you know, listen to the people that the people you listen to, you know, who are those folks listening to? What podcasts are they listening to? What YouTube channels are they watching? What books are they reading? And get out of the witchy section of the bookstore for crying out loud. You can only read so many introductory books. You need to do something else. There are so mm-hmm. many other kinds of topics that can inform, challenge, and build and support your spiritual practice. If I have any kind of authority, then yes, I will use it to say, go forth, learn, please. I am self-aware enough to know that I am not a teacher. I'm not a teacher of at least this subject. Any time that we ever did like Supermoot or anything, and I gave a class, it was always on like research or statistics or, you know, like that kind of thing. I never, yeah, but like, you know, I'm not, you know, I've seen people online, some folks that didn't love the book, that were like, well, you know, I was trying to learn a specific path, or I was trying to, you know, I picked this up because I wanted an, you know, I wanted to learn, you know, this or this about witchcraft. And I'm like, well, I said in the introduction, you weren't going to do that here. Mm-hmm. So sorry, but yeah, it's not that book. That's the thing. There's other books mm-hmm. for you, and they're great, and they do a lot of good stuff. So because all of those other books exist, it's okay for this book to exist. Not all books need to be the same.
Well, and it's funny. I feel like I've said this a lot. I don't know, just on interviews or like talking to people in my life too, that like, I would never tell someone, this is the one book you need to read.
Oh my gosh.
Like, on any topic. I would never say that. But I would tell people, if you want a list of books you should go look at, look at the end of Dawn's book, because there's so many good resources there. And because like you said, a lot of people don't do well garnering information from reading. So like that there are some multimedia opportunities there too. But I think that part of the book is invaluable. And I hope even people who think they don't need the book will take a look at that. So,
well, thank you. It's very kind. I always find it heartwarming when people talk about the parts of the book that I put so much of that kind of work into, the resources mm-hmm. section, some of like the ethical chapters, that kind of stuff. You know, people want to talk about the pop culture witches or, you know, the spells or something like that. And I'm like, that's cool. But like, I feel like what Dabbler's Guide is so many of those like deep dive mm-hmm. chapters, those deep dive, you know, intimate conversations with the reader. So thank you so much for recognizing that.
Oh, okay. So last quick question, and then we'll do our other question. But so we already know you're working on a novel. So that's your yep. upcoming project.
It's almost done. Yeah.
Excellent. And readers can find you, or podcast listeners can find you.
Head on Fire. Yep. The show is Head on Fire. It's from a quote that I have loved for many, many years. Seek illumination like a man with his head on fire seeks water. So mostly, I guess, you know, writing the Dabbler's Guide made me just want to be a seeker again and just mm-hmm. ask weird off the wall questions, the kinds of questions that we don't typically talk about, and go find experts in those weird, often overlooked subjects. So, you know, that's what I'm doing. So the podcast is called Head on Fire. It's available everywhere podcasts are downloaded or streamed. There is a website. There's not much there other than show notes, but it is headonfirepod.com, because Head on Fire was taken. Boo. And you can find me on most forms of social media at Head on Fire Pod.
And we'll make sure all those links are in the show notes for people. So last question is based on my, whether or not, you know, astrology is true. I identify as a Scorpio and a nosy one at that. So I always like to talk about stuff you're not supposed to talk about.
Yay!
The basis of the podcast, honestly.
Yes.
But we're going to take it to the next level. So I'm going to roll with die.
Okay.
I always want to say dice, but it's one. So it's die.
Yes, it's die.
And one of five topics: death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And I'll ask you a question.
Babe, let's go through all of them.
Kind of related to all writing. Of them.
And just if I roll a six, that die.
You get to pick. If I roll a six, you get to pick which one.
Okay.
Two, sex.
Woo-hoo. Yes.
All right. So you have been tapped to write a book on the history of sex magic. Where do you start?
Oh, God. Oh, I don't know. I would go back to school. I would go to JSTOR. You know, I would go to an academic library and I would start researching there. That's so boring. To research the history of sex magic, where would you go? I would go to a college library. I would go to an academic library and I would go seek out what higher level research has been done for that. And see how recently those publications were put out. Are there any journal articles? Have maybe psychologists or anthropologists written about it? I would certainly take a turn into publications from the last 3 years coming out of witchy publishers, because I want to see what conversation is happening right now. People always tell you, if you want to write in a genre, you need to be reading what's been published in the last 3 years. So if you want to write a romance novel and your big romance references are from the 90s or 80s or whatever, you are not ready to write a romance today. You need to be reading what is currently being published. Mm-hmm. So I would read whatever is out there right now on sex magic that's been most recently published inside of our community. But yeah, then I would hit up a college library hardcore. That's so boring.
No, but I mean, I always kind of like most people, I would be like, I would say no. But you immediately went, no, I'm going to do this. Well, and you went with it.
Well, if you're going to pay me to write a book, I'm going to do it. But like, I'm going to go all in. But I would probably do it sort of like what I did with the Dabbler's Guide. I would look at the different kinds of way, like what does sex magic mean to people? What do people experience? Like, I wouldn't keep it just a pagan, specifically witchy. I would do something similar here and just say, how do different communities ritualize sex? How do different that kind of thing. And maybe I need to be writing this down. TM copyright.
Are you taking
copyright? Notes? maybe that'll be book three.
This is definitely not a topic I want to particularly write on. I would like to read the book when you're finished, but I'm not interested in writing it. So.
Because again, I'm not the expert. So where would I mean, what do I say in the book? I'm not the expert. So what was my first instinct? Go find the experts, go find the experts.
You are true to form. That's true to form. Yeah. Yeah. So because you said that, if you're going to pay me to write this book, I'm going to ask you the money question too.
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
So if you knew that you would never get paid another dime writing and publishing, would you still do it?
I mean, I did for many, many years. I would always write. I'd be very sad because I'm just now getting to a point in my career where there's possibility for once. There's people that are calling me. So it'd be very sad. Only because publishing means that other people get to experience your work. And while I would always write, I've written thousands and thousands and thousands of poems and short stories over the years. So I would always continue to write, but I'd be a little sad if other people didn't get to read it.
Oh, you could still publish. You just won't get paid.
Sure. Are we talking royalty? Like I can't even get an advance because that.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's funny because I think there's so many small presses and with independent publishing, an advance, like what is that kind of thing?
I know.
For a lot of writers.
I know. Yeah. I know. Ooh. Yeah. And I don't know. I have a lot of opinions about advances and that kind of thing. I mean, I've talked to authors in the last few years who were like, wait, you got an advance? Well, I didn't get an advance. It's like, then you should not have written that book, baby. I'm sorry. Like you don't write for free you don't let other people make money off of you for free. So I have a lot of views on.
And I think that partly is why so many people have chosen independent publishing, because if you're writing in a niche field or you're writing.
Sure.
If you're going to do all the work, you might as well make money yourself.
You might as well make the money yourself. There are plenty of routes to make money. I mean, writing in a niche genre, and for as big as y'all think that some of these witchy publishers are, they are small. They are so small, mm-hmm. so small, and in the grand scheme of publishers, reclaiming some of that so that you can, least you can get paid for the work that you put. I mean, some of these books that come out from some of these authors are just incredibly well researched and incredibly well written, and they just don't get seen because these smaller publishers don't have the marketing budget to get them out there. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I get that. That's valid. But like, I don't know if an independent writer, you know, just spent $500 on a social media ad, that could hit more eyeballs than all of the marketing that some of these witchy publishers do ever for you. So, I
mean, and there are independent authors making six and seven
plenty figures. Of money. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's a hustle. You know, I self-published While I Wait to Be a God Again right smack at the beginning of the pandemic. So I didn't get to go quite on that same journey with that book. I had big plans for that one, but all of any tour, any pop-up, any appearance at a bookstore, anything like that, that all got canceled. So that was great.
Yeah, I do kind of have a soft spot in my heart for anybody who put a book out during the pandemic. I published in I put one out in 2020 early, and yeah, it was the one right when the pandemic started in the beginning of 2020 and one in 2021. And I was like, book tour, no nothing.
While I Wait to Be a God Again came out in February of 2020, and Dabbler's Guide came out September 2021, and that sucked. What really sucked is because Dabbler's Guide came out and we thought that my publishing time would be right around the time when we could start doing in-person events. So there were some things on the calendar. I might have been able to fly to New York, you know, do some of those kind of in-person cool author things that especially you get to do at a big five and stuff like that. And then Delta. And then all that, you know, next wave and all that, and all that got canceled. So that sucked. So maybe book three or four. I don't know.
Yep. Well, I'm going to cross my fingers for book three and we'll end it on a hopeful note. But I just want to thank you so much for being on the show. This was a fantastic conversation and thank you for being a podcast inspiration too.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. Congratulations on the new podcast and good luck.
Thank you. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Kaifel Agostini, who also designed our logo. Our music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew K. End, licensed from Pixabay. You can find transcripts and all our previous episodes at witchlitpod.com and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at witchlitpod. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow or subscribe and consider giving us a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps other witches find the show. Thanks for listening and for reading Witchy.